Hey everybody, it's Mike Jeffers, ChicagoJazz.com, and welcome to Talkin' Jazz. We are here at Johnny O's, episode 122. I am excited to have the great guitarist Neil Alger is here on the show.
Thank you. Wanted to have Neil on
for a while because Neil is constantly playing all over town and traveling and touring. Well, maybe not as much as you used to be, but you're definitely doing a lot of stuff. But I always wanted to have you on, Neil, because I thought it was interesting because of all the different styles you play. But before we get into any of that, are you happy to be here at Johnny O's in the middle of an afternoon? I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm not often in Bridgeport, so I love it, yeah.
And it's not too far, actually, from where you're at. So, you know,
right.
As Dave Gemmelo always says, all roads lead to Uptown. Some roads lead to Bridgeport. So.
Oh, okay. 55 does, yeah.
55 leads to Bridgeport. All right, enough of my nonsense. So let's talk, before we get into all of your background and everything, you've got... You're really into the Brazilian thing these days, as far as your groups go, and you've got a kind of a regular every other Wednesday happening at Winter's Jazz Club, which is at 465 North McClure Court. I know a lot of you have heard me talk about Winter's. If you've not been there, this is the place to go. But also, I think it's specifically a great place for everyone to go and hear your Brazilian trio, because, you know, Winter's is such an intimate room. You can really hear all the nuances. But why don't we talk about the Brazilian trio? You've got a show coming up January 30th, and then every other Wednesday after that. Mm-hmm. Who's in the group, and what kind of music is it? Other than Brazilian.
I have Kurt Bly on bass and Luis Everling on drums, who's been in the Brazilian scene in Chicago for 20, I forget what he told me the other night, 25 years. Mm-hmm. So they both have a history with the music already, which is fabulous.
Well, Luis grew up in Brazil, right?
Or something? Yeah, he grew up in the south of Brazil, yeah. So he knows the rhythms, he knows them like the back of his hand, which is a beautiful thing. He's teaching me every time I play with him. But we take... I would say, you know, the philosophy behind Winter's is really standards and the Great American Songbook. So I've taken some of Brazilian tunes that have some visibility in the Americas already.
Okay.
You know, there's some tunes that like Sinatra sang or so there's some
Joe
that are
Beam and things like
some,
that.
Yeah, Joe Beam. There are some that are already familiar to American audiences, so I try to capitalize on those. Like the song Brazil, for instance, or this song Copacabana that I think
Barry Manilow, right?
That's a different Copacabana. But so, yeah, I do that to kind of like fit into the Winter's philosophy, but there's also just a ton of great singer-songwriters in Brazil. Caetano Veloso, Gilberto Gil, Milton Nascimento, and they all have these beautiful tunes that have beautiful chord changes, but the rhythms are just different than jazz.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to use those as vehicles for improvisation and play them just like I would, you know, Fly Me to the Moon or what have you. So, yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
How did you get so far deep into the Brazilian, like, music? Because, you know, you're mentioning local artists in Brazil, it seems like, right? Or they're probably nationally known artists, but in Brazil. I mean, these aren't people that normally, you know, every other musician knows what you're talking about. So how did you do a deep study? Did something just grab you and just suck you into that whole culture? what happened?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. Well, I have a Brazilian wife, my wife, Marilia.
Okay.
We just celebrated our nine-year anniversary
yesterday.
And I already, you know, was infatuated somewhat with Brazilian music for a long time. You know, we as jazz musicians, we have to learn bossa novas. But she started introducing me to all these different regions and all these styles. It's a massive country. So, yeah, I guess I was also kind of thirsting for something new. I love standards and I love straight-ahead jazz, but I think something inside of me wanted something new.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I've gone really deep. I've read a lot of books. It's all almost been like a ethnomusicological study in a way.
Have you've been to Brazil, I take it?
Yeah, I've been a few times.
So you've probably been down there. Have you seen some of these artists perform live? Have you played down there?
Not as many as I would like, but actually I've seen some of them perform here in Chicago, oddly enough. But I've played some gigs down there and met some musicians that have played with some very big names. So it's been fun.
How does, before we get into the whole thing, but I mean, with all of the different styles you play. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about your background and how you came up and how you got into all this. But, I mean, you know, on one night you might see Neil playing with a Steely Dan cover band. And another night he's playing a straight-ahead jazz gig. On another night you're playing a fusion gig. I think you have a rock band, too, sometimes that you play with and put out at Reggie's. I think I've seen your listings and stuff, yeah. You know. Mm-hmm. And the Brazilian thing. So, I mean, how do you split your brain and not go crazy? I mean, because if you're doing the Brazilian stuff, it's completely different, isn't it? As opposed to like some of these other styles. So is it something just consciously, or is it just natural to you and you can just do it?
I can't really explain it, honestly. I don't feel like I'm wearing a lot of hats, but I love different styles of music. That it just really comes down to that. If I had to just do one thing all of the time, I don't know if I would be satisfied artistically and spiritually, you know. Mm-hmm. So, to me, it's not that hard of a jump. Unless I'm doing on the same gig, I'm having to go from Brazilian to Steely Dan to rock. I've always liked a lot of different styles. So for me, it's very fulfilling, and it's not that difficult to jump from one to the other.
Yeah.
Oddly enough.
Huh.
I don't know why.
So how did you get started? Did you growing up, did you start playing guitar young? Is that how you started, you know, got into music, or how did that all come about?
I actually started on drums first.
Smart guy. Yeah, okay, well.
Yay! Yeah, see? Drummer. I was 7, and what got the ball rolling was my dad introduced me to the Beatles, and I was a Beatles freak with my brother.
Oh, yeah,
and,
we
wanted to copy the drum beats, and my dad would say, check out the vocal harmonies on that last tune, check out the bass line, what Paul McCartney's
was your
doing.
Dad a musician or just a lover?
He loves music. He plays a little bit, but really just a lover.
Yeah.
And he was friends with a lot of musicians in the late 60s. But so drums for a little while, and then around I was 11 when the guitar came into the picture, and then drums just kind of just faded away. I played in marching band in high school, and still kept up with it for a little while, but guitar kind of took over in my late teens.
So probably because what we were talking about before with the Brazilian melodies and things like that, do you think that you kind of went towards the guitar because of that, the chordal? I mean, you can play melodies, you can hear the chord changes, you can play the chord changes and create. I mean, that's probably what drew you over to the guitar, right? Get on a melodic instrument as opposed to drums.
Maybe, you know, I was only 11. I wasn't really thinking about it that deeply at the time. I mean, actually my cousin had a guitar and he was competitive.
Oh,
and he's like, yeah, you can't do this. And then that's kind of how I started. But I guess maybe subconsciously I was thinking, hey, I can, you know, make some music now with melody rather than mm-hmm. just banging out rhythms.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So are you jamming through high school and stuff, like rock band stuff, learning Beatles tunes, learning Led Zeppelin? I mean, is that kind of where you're at that point, or were you starting to branch in? Did you hear some jazz stuff at that point?
Good question. I had a heavy metal band in high school. I was a headbanger. I was into Metallica, Megadeth, Anthrax.
Yep.
And
so was I, by the way.
Just okay.
For the record.
All right.
For the record.
Yeah,
Iron
we
Maiden.
Have a lot of common. Yeah. Yeah, Iron Maiden, sure, absolutely. Judas Priest. So with my friends, some of which were already in the band program at school, we had our heavy metal band. But then my band director said, hey, the jazz band is open for guitarists. I know you don't have any familiarity with jazz, but it's open if you want to try. So junior year of high school is when jazz started a little bit. My parents never listened to jazz. They were classic rock people.
Yeah.
So I was like, wow, I can solo all the time. This sounds kind of fun.
So that's really how you got into it. And you tell me if I'm wrong, but I bet once you got in there, maybe you played a couple of tunes and then maybe you started going down the rabbit hole. Maybe you heard one guitar player or somebody. Was there a specific jazz guitar player that you heard and said, wait a minute, that's a lot different than, like, you know, Ozzy Osbourne here.
Is,
you know.
Yeah. It wasn't guitar players at first, and I'm not sure exactly why. Maybe because I didn't have a private lesson teacher at that time, but it was Charlie Parker at first. Yeah. He was my first big introduction in jazz. Yeah.
All the melodies probably, and all the soloing that he's doing. You probably want to check that out and see what it was.
Yeah, absolutely. And then somebody told me about Wes Montgomery somewhere down the line, and I'm like, oh, okay. That's what that's about. Yeah, but yeah, bebop, because I went to the Jamie Ebersole Jazz Camp, and David Baker was a huge influence, saying, okay, you need to learn the language of bebop. Here's what you have to do. Here's my books. And so I started absorbing Sonny Rollins and Charlie Parker and those guys.
Yeah.
And then a little bit later, Joe Pass and Wes Montgomery.
So were you all in, or you were still probably listening to the rock and heavy metal and doing jazz and everything? You didn't
for
just
a little while,
a
yeah. They sat or... side by side for a little while.
Yeah. So what was it about Wes? When you heard Wes, I mean, was that the guy that you're like, I can't believe a guitar can actually do that, or what he's playing on it? Was it something that you were just like, whoa?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
yeah.
How can you not be astounded by what he did? Yeah.
Yeah.
To me, there's still nobody better, you know.
What is it about Wes? Do you think it's, you know, I mean, we probably name a lot of stuff, but like, let's pick a main thing. Like, for me, with Wes, outside of all his playing and everything, it's his pocket. It's where he plays. His phrasing and all that stuff, but that's his pocket to me.
Yeah.
And I've never heard anybody with a pocket. I mean, maybe Pat Martino gets somewhat close to Wes's pocket, but I mean, Wes's pocket is just like, it's you don't even need a band around him, and the thing's grooving. So what was it with him, with you, or is that something that you heard with him?
Well, yeah, I mean, over the years, many things have hit me about him. I mean, at first, just from a purely technical point of view, the thing about going from single note soloing to octaves and then to chord soloing, that texture thing that he developed that was unheard of at the time.
Yeah.
So that kind of knocked me out. I'm like, how can somebody play octaves that fast and with his thumb? but I think even more than that was just his groove. He never played anything out of the pocket, really. But his melodic invention and the way he was able to develop melodies in his solos, taking one simple melodic idea and developing it, that's something that my teacher also pointed out in his playing, and I'm like, wow, okay, so jazz playing is not just about licks and memorized patterns, it's about, you know, telling a story and developing something. So that blew me, and his harmonic genius is amazing too.
Is that something, talking about licks, because you know you get into the rock realm and you know this is like, you know, I think there's books of licks, right? Like you can, here's your Randy Rhodes licks and here's this lick and here's that lick, and then they apply it to that. But as a guitarist, is that one of those things that is tough to kind of, you probably want to learn the licks so you know what they are, but then you want to also do your own thing. And as a guitarist, you know, if you listen to modern music and stuff, there's the hooks, right? There's the licks. Here it is. And it's so easy just to fall into that regular thing and do that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
How hard is it for a guitarist or even for you to know it, but then get out of it and create your own voice on top of it?
You know, that's a really good question. And I get that question from students, because they, you know, they'll tell me, you know, I'm learning these licks. How do I make it my own thing? And how do I make it sound like it's not just this regurgitated force pattern? That I don't know if I have a clear answer for that. I think the best I can give you is that just subconsciously the notes start to filter into your playing, and there comes a point where you know it so well that it just naturally comes out. And depending on what other vocabulary you have to have together, you might start it in a different way than it was originally put together, or you might end it in a different way. So I don't. It's a tough thing to articulate, because I don't know when I stopped learning licks and when my own stuff started, and it's a gray area in there.
Well, and let's probably talk a little bit about practice time, right? So when you're doing this and you're getting learning and stuff like that, I mean, how much are you playing? You're probably playing in jazz band, maybe in high school, maybe you're just getting out of high school, you're doing rock band stuff, blah, blah, blah. Then you're practicing, right? And are you transcribing a lot?
At that time? Yeah, I was transcribing a lot, and I was keeping a log, a practice log. Did this tune in 12 keys this day. I did this pattern in 12 keys that day. Yeah, I was keeping track of...
Oh.
I don't do that as much anymore, because the practice doesn't have to be quite that formalized.
Right.
But yeah, I had to... I was transcribing all the time and just absorbing the... Much like I'm doing now with Brazilian music, which is a whole different story. Yeah, just trying to absorb as much as I can of the language so that it comes out, you know.
Yeah. I mean... from a practice standpoint, and you're learning that stuff, and let's talk a little bit to the maybe the beginner or intermediate guitar players that are trying to get to finding their own voice on it. Do you think that just by doing that through osmosis, just by doing it and doing it and doing it, and then experimenting and then soloing and doing it, it just automatically, it takes time, right, to get that voice to start coming out, to be able to just play over stuff without regurgitating things. It's a lot of work. Am I wrong?
Absolutely, yeah. But it's hard to teach. It's hard to really teach that, because it just happens. It's not something you can plan necessarily, especially on a gig. If you're not in the practice room and you're on a gig, you're like, how can I use this vocabulary and not sound like I'm just copying Wes or Bird or whoever?
Right. I think that's always the hardest part too for students. And I mean, I'm not teaching anymore, but I know you're still teaching some, right?
I'm teaching quite a bit these days. Yeah.
So I know that's one of those things where they're doing this and doing this, but it's just they hit a wall probably because they're like, I can't get it to that next level, and then all of a sudden, it starts happening.
Yeah.
But as a teacher, you can't tell them when it's going to happen either. But if they
I was equated to learning the English language. I mean, you know, babies and especially me having a 7-year-old son, I've seen the progression with the language thing, and seeing how he adapts things picks them up verbatim at first and then starts to toy with them. Yeah, it's just a natural organic thing that happens, and you can kind of teach it, but you kind of can't. It just kind of happens naturally on its own.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would just say to young musicians, just practice as much as you can, transcribe and absorb the masters, and eventually it will start to happen.
Right.
Your own voice will start to come out too.
And it's going to take a little while.
Yeah, it takes time. It's not going to happen overnight.
Because if you could tell somebody, here's what you got to do, and in 6 months, you play that last page there and you're good to go. You wouldn't be sitting in a hot dog stand with me right now. You'd be touring the world as a billionaire because you cracked the code, you know?
Yeah, the code.
So you got out of high school. Where'd you end up going to college?
I went to NIU.
Okay. So why did you decide? Was it a specific teacher there or just the program in general?
Well, quite frankly, just being cheap, being an in-state school, that was part of it. I'm not going to lie. You know, Berkeley was very appealing. I had a small scholarship to go there, but it was just insanely expensive.
Yeah.
But Fareed Haq, who's incredible, had him as a guest.
I just had him on the feature interview. Yeah.
So I knew of him. His reputation was already looming large in the early 90s. So that and the proximity and Tony Garcia was there at that time, this trombone instructor and just general jazz person. So I knew the faculty was pretty happening.
Mm-hmm.
So,
up at NIU, you're still able to get into the city, right? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, although I didn't really as much when I was there, but I did immediately afterward.
Yeah,
yeah.
So you got out, you started playing. I mean, you probably hit the scene. Did you start just sitting in constantly?
I went to a lot of jam sessions. Yeah.
Is that the MO? Like, I mean,
that's what I tell students, get out there. Yeah, yeah. You as well. Yeah, that's how we met, right?
That's right. Yeah, you were running the jam at Big Joe's, I think, right? You just got back into town. I think maybe Darren was running it.
Yeah, Darren was running it. I was in the house band for a little while there. Yeah.
Yeah. So I always tell everybody I was playing, sitting in 7 nights a week, and you probably were doing the same thing.
Wow.
Like every single place you could go, I had like a circuit that I would go to.
Man.
And just sit in constantly and suck every single place I went. And then I got a little bit better. And then finally I started sounding like decent. And took a while, and there it is, you know.
So, it's a great learning ground. But
It is. And it's not like it used to be anymore, because I don't know how many jam sessions. I mean, there's jam sessions, but not compared to like back in the 90s when there were jam sessions.
A lot more, a lot more.
But there's still definitely places that people should go check out.
Absolutely.
So you start playing, and you're starting playing around town and stuff. What was one of the first like studies that you had? Like, were you playing in a regular gig? Did you start your own group, or did you get into somebody's group? Or, you know, what was that first thing that you're like, this is great, I'm finally like a professional musician here?
Boy, I have to really think about that. I don't remember any particular big studies, at least not a jazz studies. I had kind of a rock study for a while. But I do remember the Jazz Bulls, which has been defunct for quite a long time now, mm-hmm. gave me my first leader gigs. I mean, it was the only, I was so green and so new in town that they were the only notable jazz venue in town that would actually give me a gig. So I didn't have a steady there, but I played there every few months with my trio.
Okay.
I remember one big gig on Thanksgiving night where I had to pass off the family.
Night.
Yeah, it's like family. I can't do it this year. I got a big gig at Bulls. Tito Carrillo was playing trumpet. Mark O'Connor's playing tenor sax. And yeah, it was a big. I felt like, all right, I'm starting to do something now.
Yeah. When did you start getting called by? Because I know that you were like one of those guys that were like starting to get calls from the established players in town to you know, as a side man here, side man there, doing different things. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you ended up with Patricia Barber too, right? I mean, didn't she brought you? I don't. Maybe you sat in with her or something. But at one point, all of a sudden, you're in with Patricia Barber's group and you're touring with Patricia Barber. But I think you were getting calls from like those bigger level people because of your knowledge and because of the way that you can move between styles. I would assume that that's probably.
I think that certainly plays a part in it. Yeah.
Really,
Mike Arnapol, the bass player, was instrumental in that. We were, you know, players still do this, but early on, you put together sessions. You know, just start, you call players that you enjoy playing with, and you put together just an impromptu kind of jam session. So
yeah.
Mike was part of a trio that I was in with Tom Hipskind, who's now in Hamilton. Incidentally, but yeah, he told Patricia, he had been had a, quite a history with her, and he said, "Hey, this guitarist, she was looking for somebody new, and he suggested me, and I sat in, and first time actually was really awful. I didn't do very well. I was very nervous, and she chose a very difficult tune. But the second time was the winner, so to speak. Yeah.
I mean, how long were you with Patricia? Like steady?
Steady for about from 2001 to about 2011. Yeah, so about a good 10 years.
And
years. I still work with her occasionally. She's recording a new record next mm-hmm. week, and I'm gonna be on
I had
some
her
of the tracks.
A couple
oh,
months
you did,
ago.
You did.
I had her
oh,
as a
geez.
Feature interview. Yeah,
boy, I need to get in a loop here.
But she was just talking. She just announced that she was going to start recording that recording. So that's great. So you're going to be on it.
That's
great. But you, I mean, with that group, that was the big touring group, right? I mean, you were in that thing. You guys were traveling, and I think you were in that with her when it was kind of like she was doing a lot of touring, wasn't she? I mean, she was
she scaled back quite a bit. Yeah, but yeah, I caught the most. I think the highest.
How did that experience? Because with Patricia, I mean, she's playing straight ahead stuff. She's playing original stuff. She interwines a lot of different styles and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Did that open up your playing in a new way as opposed to like if you never had that gig? I mean, do you think that because of all the different things you had to take on in that group with the different styles and all that stuff. I mean, mm-hmm. did it open up your playing in a...
Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. Yeah. There's two things I can say about that. The first thing is Patricia is a true improviser in the sense that, like, we would have the same set list every night for the gigs, but she would reinvent herself every night, like even intros or even the way she would interpret the song. And to me, that was an eye-opener because I tended to like take standards and kind of do them the same.
Yeah.
I don't want to say cookie-cutter way, but I would be a little safer than I would see her. So that inspired me. I'm like, okay, I really have to reinvent myself. That's really what improvising is about. That and then being able to really make music in an 8-bar or 16-bar little, like if it's not a blowing tune, if it's more of a like closer to a pop song or
mm-hmm.
where you really have to make a statement, I learned how to do that. So those two things, yeah, they were massively influenced in playing.
Well, and so. Also sound-wise too. Did you change gear at that point, or did you do anything differently with your guitar sounds or anything to fit in with what was happening, or is that really just you already had those tones and you just stuck with those tones that you already had?
Well, Patricia encouraged me to play a Stratocaster, a solid body guitar, because she didn't want the traditional warm. Hollow body.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, I could, of course, I had familiarity with that kind of instrument from rock playing.
Yeah.
But she pulled out. I mean, I definitely had to experiment with tones and stuff, and it brought me out of my comfort zone, which I'm very grateful for. Yeah, I grew a lot having to navigate those different mm-hmm. tones and stuff.
Yeah. So now bringing it all the way back to what you're doing now. So mm-hmm. taking all of those experiences, and now you're playing in the Steely Dan thing, you're playing with the Brazilian thing, you're playing here, there, 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 there. It seems to me, you know, you opened up your kind of creative mind even farther with her, right? And then you came out of that group, and now you've taken it to another level where now you're creating your own stuff, where you've got your Brazilian thing and you're able to do all these different things. But from a tone standpoint and from a creative standpoint, are you able to take that thought process that you had with Patricia and trying to, you know, keep pushing and pushing and pushing? Are you able to push that into all these new projects that you're working on now?
Somewhat. I mean, I would say more so if I play a straight ahead jazz gig or my own compositions, I'm able to do that. But with the Brazilian music, it's a little tougher to really reinvent myself each night because I'm still learning a little bit of the language of mm-hmm. that music. But I mean, there's always room for to mess with things a bit. And, you know, I can, if I decide to do a rubato intro for a certain tune that I don't usually do that for, you know, there I guess my point is there are options for me to kind of pull some of that stuff.
Well, it's got
to
be pretty cool though, because I mean, now it's almost like you're almost somewhat back to the basics with the Brazilian stuff, and now you're starting to grow the Brazilian stuff out like you grew a lot of the other things out. So like in 5 years you're going to be in a whole other place than you are right now, even though you're in a really great place with the Brazilian music, right? I mean, is that kind of how you're feeling?
Absolutely, yeah. I would like to, yeah. It's really given me a new lease on my musical life. I feel like a little kid again because I'm learning. You know, I'm transcribing again. I'm learning a new language, and it's really like opened up a lot of different stuff.
Now you've got a show coming up February 11th at the Jazz Showcase, mm-hmm. and I'm going to let you tell us about it because it's a little bit different than the Brazilian group. Well, it's a style, so why don't you talk about it so I don't screw it up?
Oh, no problem. So, as I was saying earlier, you know, Brazil's such a big country. There, every region has a different like style, and in Rio. Specifically, right before samba started, well, they kind of commingled, I guess, in a way. But choro is an instrumental style that developed in Rio around the 1880s, 1890s, and it was the Brazilians' first kind of instrumental popular music.
Okay.
And it merged European melodies and harmonies with Afro-Brazilian rhythms. So it's kind of like taking, kind of originally like European classical music. And adapting it with a little bit of African, you know, syncopation.
Yeah.
And it's challenging music because the melodies are very ornate. There's a lot of notes, and there are three sections to the tunes, as opposed to a jazz tune where you have, okay, you'll have AABA, but these choro tunes, it's AABAC. A. So I don't want to get too much into it, but I'm playing a 7-string guitar, and so that's also been a new thing
is that just a 7-string guitar? Is it called a specific kind of guitar?
Yeah, well, in Portuguese, they say 7-string. Yeah, they say violão sete cordas, which means basically guitar.
Where does that give you on the range? It just adds, it's lower? Or
yeah, it adds me one lower string. Because in choro and traditional samba, they have these really cool counterpoint bass lines. They're called baixarias. And I'm learning that language. Those are a bunch of licks in and of themselves.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to learn that. But yeah, so choro, it's a really cool instrument, primarily instrumental. There are some vocalists in the choro genre, but it kind of has a samba beat, but not quite as syncopated as dun, 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 dun. It's more just 16 notes with the pandero. And so this gig coming up, I formed this duo. Well, we co-formed it with this flautist, Julie Coyden, mm-hmm. who's coming from the classical end of things. I'm coming from the jazz end of things, but we love the choro music, and we sometimes flesh out the group a little bit with an extra percussionist or an extra stringed instrument. So at Hey Nani, coming up on, what was that?
February 11th.
Oh yeah,
the showcase.
February.
And then at Hey Nani, which is a great spot in Arlington Heights, you've got something coming up March 5th, and mm-hmm. is that similar to what you're doing, or is that going to be the Brazilian trio?
That's probably going to be the Brazilian trio again. Yeah, they're celebrating Carnival, the big party in Brazil, yeah. And that'll be more of a samba party music kind of gig. Yeah. So we'll kick it up a notch.
So it seems to me like you've got every other Wednesday at Winters, so January 30th, and then every other Wednesday after that, wintersjazzclub.com, by the way. And mm-hmm. then Jazz Showcase, February 11th, mm-hmm. jazzshowcase.com. And then Hey Nani, which is March 5th, and I think it's heynani.com. I'm pretty positive that's what that
is. I think so, yeah.
And then, of course, neilalger.com will have all of this great information up on his website very soon. But it seems to me like within the next 6, 8, 9 months, if you're playing this much Brazilian stuff, you'd probably be a master at that point, right?
Well, that's the idea. Maybe not in 8 months, but yeah.
But that's the only way to really learn this stuff, is to just to go dive in the deep end now that you have a handle on it and just start playing, right? I mean, that's the way to do everything. It's just push the thing forward.
Absolutely.
You have a grasp on it and get moving and start doing more stuff with it.
And the great thing is the number one, the Brazilian community has been very welcoming to me, you know, putting up with me wanting to learn all this stuff. And the second thing is jazz clubs, you know, it's taking a little bit of a chance, going in a little bit of a direction. You know, Winters with their philosophy with, you know, wanting to keep the Great American Songbook. I'm grateful to Scott for letting me try this, and he seems to really enjoy it. So,
yeah.
So I know it's a little bit off the beaten path, but there's still plenty of jazz content in there.
Well, there's a lot of jazz content, but I tend to think everybody loves a groove. So
yeah,
if it's grooving, if it's grooving, pretty much 9 out of 10 people are going to totally dig it, even if it's not like, even if you're not playing Charlie Parker tunes. I mean,
sure.
They're going to be like, oh, this is great. You know, I mean, that's the name of the game a lot of times. And,
yeah,
and
sure.
This stuff lends itself perfectly. So, all right, so neilalger.com for all the information. Neil, this has been great, man. I really appreciate
you coming
down. Thanks
so much for having
me,
man.
It's been dynamite. I've wanted to have you down here. And then as you get more things happening with these projects, keep me posted. And we'll definitely make sure our audience sees what's happening. Of course, one last time, Winters Jazz Club every Wednesday, starting January 30th, February 11th, Jazz Showcase Hey Nani, March 5th. And as I always end our shows, hopefully Neil will see you out at a show somewhere in one of these spots, and hopefully I will see you somewhere soon. But if I don't, hopefully we will both see you somewhere out on the scene.